browns, bacon, and homemade biscuits. And the price is right. Don't worry about lingering too long. Refills abound while patrons read the local paper. Next, we decided to hit the sand. We had never been to Malachite Beach, which is about 25 miles away, and made our way there, passing the few condos on Mustang Island outside of town and the causeway to Corpus. Malachite Beach is a beautiful area of Padre Island National Seashore that prohibits vehicles on the beach. The visitor center has a good information area in addition to showers and chair rentals. Since we arrived early in the morning and it was March, there weren't too many people out and about. But the ranger at the visitor center said that during the summer, Malachite is definitely happening. We took the opportunity to drive down Padre Island's South Beach. You can go only 5 miles in a vehicle without four-wheel drive. Beyond that point, you'll need it for the remaining 55 miles along the National Seashore until you hit the Mansfield Cut. We decided to head back to Port A to find the ferry to San Jose Island. Locals call it St. Joe Island. It didn't take us long to find Woody's Sports Center on Cotter. We purchased our tickets for the ferry, $9.95 apiece, and headed to destination on South Allister to buy chairs and sunscreen. You'd think we would have remembered to pack these items, but we didn't. Then we went back to Woody's and hung out on the dock, watching the fishing boats come in while we waited for the ferry to depart. The trip over didn't take long, about 10 or 15 minutes. We got off at the pier and walked along a concrete wall to the Gulf. I was surprised at all of the trash plastic bottles, shoes, beer cans, you name it. But once we rounded the tip of the island and walked along the shore, the trash cleared. We planted our chairs inside the dunes because it was so windy and began reading. All we could hear were seagulls and the sea breeze whistling. After about an hour, we got up and walked around. One of the other passengers on the ferry had told us that we could walk to the fence, but beyond that was off limits. The island is owned by the Bass family, and they use it for running cattle. The water was cold, but felt good under my feet. Soon, Kit began to notice shells. All of a sudden, there were lots of them. And they were pretty. I immediately told him that I hoped to find a sand dollar because I had never found one. He said he hadn't either. The search was on. It didn't take long for him to find one. Then I did. We reached the fence and turned around. The clouds were beginning to block the sun and the wind had picked up, so we started back. We barely had time to gather our things before the ferry arrived to pick us up. When we returned to Woody's, we were starved. Virginia's on the Bay is right down the street, across from the Tarpon. So we went there to enjoy the view of the harbor. The place was packed, and the food was good. The shrimp poor boy sandwich really hit the spot. So did the cold Coors Light. Kit wanted to go jogging, so we went back to the Tarpon, and I snuggled into one of the rocking chairs and got in a few more chapters of my book. After a long nap, it was time to get ready for dinner. We had made reservations at Beulah's, which is behind the Tarpon Inn. The night was perfect. The wind had died down, and it was just a tad bit chilly. We had asked for a table outside and were promptly seated at one with a superb view of the courtyard. The ambience couldn't have gotten any better. We were sitting on the lovely porch of a building that was constructed in 1904, sipping delicious Pinot Noir and talking about our wonderful day at the beach. Our waiter was French, and we asked him how in the world he landed in Port A. He followed a girl, they married, and they settled there. Long live romance. Our entrees of the pecan-crusted amberjack and the duck were superb. We lingered over coffee. Right when we paid the tab and got up to leave, the wind picked up. and a cold front blew in. We rushed over to the other guys, a nearby restaurant owned by Guy Carnathan, who also owns Beulah's. We had a nightcap and talked to some locals about the real estate market in Port Aransas. We discovered that property taxes were going sky high. So much for Port A staying undiscovered. Sunday morning we checked out and went to Beeman's on Beach Street for coffee. They had enclosed the patio since our last visit, but not much else had changed. I hate to say it, but the coffee at Beeman's isn't that great. We come here for the fantastic cinnamon rolls and the atmosphere. Locals ride their bikes, grab some coffee and a roll, and shoot the hay. Beach Street is a funky little street that is home to restaurants, retail shops, the Port Aransas Community Theater, and brightly painted houses. While Kit read the paper, I snuck into Pat Stone's Silver Fox Trading Company next door to see what they had for sale. The jewelry, dresses, and knickknacks caught my eye, but I purchased a pair of flip-flops instead. A real beach buy. Even though we didn't want to leave, we knew our weekend was coming to an end and drove over to the ferry, the car ferry that travels between Port Aransas and Aransas Pass is free and open 24 hours. It should not be confused with the ferry to San Jose Island. We took our time getting back to Austin, hoping to make our relaxing weekend last forever. We'll be back.
Hello, this is Kay, reading from the Texas Monthly Archives. June 1979, Soup on Ice. Combat the long, hot summer with gazpacho, the coolest thing that ever happened to a tomato, by Martha Shulman. Issue, June 1979. In June, when homegrown tomatoes start to ripen, I start making gazpacho, the well-dressed salad in soup's clothing. I keep fresh batches in the refrigerator to drink like juice when I'm not in the mood for a hot meal or to serve to friends on special occasions. Gazpacho solves a multitude of summer's problems. It is cool. It is simple. It can be made in large quantities. It is a meal in itself, yet it goes beautifully with brunch, lunch, or dinner, and it can be elegant or casual. But most important, it is one of the best ways for a tomato to express itself. Of course, gazpacho came a long way without the tomato. The soup was concocted in Spain before the New World fruit reached Europe, and Spain today has almost as many versions of gazpacho, with and without tomatoes, as it has villages. Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein wrote of an ineffable gazpacho they ate in Macutalaga, an entirely different one in Seville, a suaver gazpacho at Coacutardoba, and one at Segovia that was outrageously coarse. I began in Madrid, which actually isn't the best spot to look for gazpacho. In a barren, often chilly region, the climate is described as 9 months of winter and 3 months of hell. Madrid's climate does not encourage an ice-cold soup. During those 3 months of hell, though, gazpacho is served in all the restaurants, but it is always named after its place of origin. The version I found most often in Madrid and elsewhere in Spain is called gazpacho andaluz, named for the vast, hot, south-central region of Andalusia. Quite similar to the gazpacho we eat in our country, it is thick, smooth, and salmon-colored, savory with tomatoes, onions, garlic, and olive oil, and tart with just the right amount of vinegar. Bread, often soaked in water or garlicky olive oil, is the thickener. Sometimes it is served ice-cold, sometimes at room temperature, but always with several garnishes to give it extra body and texture. But there is more to this story than gazpacho andaluz. The evolution of gazpacho parallels the arrival of its various components in Spain. The Romans, who occupied Iberia from the 2nd century BC to the 5th century, brought with them olives and new methods of viticulture. Today, Spain is the largest olive producer in Europe. Italy is a close second, and olive oil flavors almost every dish, except those native to the northern regions, and it is always used in gazpacho. Where wine is produced, so is vinegar, and it too is another early ingredient in the soup. In fact, some say that the word gazpacho comes from the Latin word posca, a vinegar and water beverage the Roman soldiers drank. Other connoisseurs say the name comes from an Arabic word for soaked bread. The Romans may have brought vinegar water to Spain, but the Moors, who occupied Spain from the 8th century to the 15th, delivered a more aristocratic broth, compared to vinegar water at least. Their gazpacho, which is still served in Spain today, consisted of garlic, bread, olive oil, lemon juice, water, and salt. The Muslims brought an advanced civilization to Spain. They built gorgeous places like Cordoba, the largest city in Europe during the Middle Ages, elaborate mosques, and palaces like the Alhambra at Granada, with its mosaics and fountains, its flush toilets and great bathtubs, which boasted three water spigots, hot, cold, and perfumed. They also brought a great abundance of food, sugarcane, rice, figs, dates, bitter oranges, mulberries, pomegranates, lemons, citrons, and almonds. Almonds became the basis for an early gazpacho that is popular today in Malaga on the Mediterranean coast. It is an aromatic mixture of ground almonds, garlic, olive oil, vinegar, and bread. This gazpacho, ajo blanco, white garlic gazpacho, is always topped with peeled green grapes to temper the garlic flavor. Another pre-tomato gazpacho is a simple pale green soup made of water, onions, thin slices of cucumber, small chunks of bread soaked in olive oil, vinegar, and lots of garlic. This is served today in Portugal and in the adjacent Extremadura region of Spain, and it is now often enriched with eggs. It may be hard to imagine gazpacho without tomatoes, but remember, they are indigenous to the New World, as are green peppers, potatoes, pumpkins, corn, squash, and chocolate, and didn't make their way to Europe until the 16th century. Some of the new edibles from the Americas, like chocolate, gained instant fame in Europe. But tomatoes were at first mistrusted. They were thought to be poisonous, to cause cancer, and to have dangerous aphrodisiac effects. The French called them pommes d'amour, love apples. For two centuries, they were grown only as ornamental plants until the Italians began to cultivate them for eating. The Spaniards followed suit and soon invented a sauce of tomatoes, onions, garlic, green peppers, pimento, and herbs for seasoning eggs and fish. In Andalusia, where the sun drenches the land and tomatoes grow full and ripe, the peasants began to incorporate these forbidden fruits, along with sweet peppers, into their noonday meals. Their lunch pails were wooden bowls, and in them they would blend together stale bread, garlic, and salt, then add tomatoes, sweet peppers, olive oil, vinegar, and water, stirring and pounding these ingredients with a wooden spoon. Peasants and laborers still make this refreshing gazpacho in their wooden bowls, eating little else through the hot days of summer. The only difference between the peasants' meals and the gazpachos I ate as first courses in restaurants and homes through Spain is the presence of garnishes, an assortment of chopped summer vegetables like tomatoes, cucumbers, bell peppers, and onions, as well as croutons and diced hard-boiled eggs, are passed around in little bowls. In the homes of the rich, gazpacho is served in a variety of ways, as a first course, a salad, or a beverage accompanying an entree. I have even read that gazpacho can be a dessert, though I've never eaten it as such. I make my gazpacho in a blender, which is becoming common in the old world too, as blenders work their way into many households. I incorporate a carrot and plenty of fresh basil, which none of the Spanish versions call for. The basil, a key ingredient in my opinion, gives the gazpacho a tangy, sweet fragrance. I use lemon juice instead of vinegar, and my soup is darker and has more texture than the gazpachos I ate in Spain. I add sliced fresh mushrooms and grated carrots to the usual garnishes, and top each serving with a dollop of plain yogurt and a handful of sunflower seeds and alfalfa sprouts. Sometimes, when I want more protein, I spoon the soup over a mixture of vegetables and slivered tofu, bean curd, then add sprouts and sunflower seeds as garnishes. Served like this with a slice of whole grain bread, gazpacho is a wholesome, light meal, perfect when the weather is hot. When it seems as if summer is never going to end, I fix gazpacho a la food expert Michael Field with white wine. It is the perfect medicine.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from Texas Monthly. This is the April 1996 edition. The Ultimate Hill Country Tour by Joe Nick Potoski. From Devil's Backbone to Utopia, and yes, Fredericksburg, here's a guide to the towns, scenic views, back roads, and all the stops along the way. Some say it is the green hills rising out of the flatlands as Texas's gateway to the west that make the hill country special. Others are drawn to the noble oaks, the pastoral fields, the artesian springs from which rivers flow clear and cold past limestone bluffs, the abrupt ravines and pocket canyons, the rock-strewn ranchland, the fine sturdy craftsmanship of its German towns, and the even sturdier stock of people who built them. For me, though, the real beauty of the Texas Hill Country lies in its many geographic contradictions. The Hill Country is the geographic and emotional essence of Texas, yet it is like nowhere else in the state. The Hill Country is an abrupt change from the plains to the east, but it is by no means mountainous like far west Texas. The land appears gentle, but it has thin, difficult soil. But no part of Texas has more wildflowers in the spring. The Hill Country shares in none of the great Texas myths. No cotton, no cattle kingdoms, no oil. In an urban state, it remains a place of small towns and villages. Railroads bypass the Hill Country because of the difficult terrain, and even today, with the exception of Interstate 10, no heavily traveled major highway traverses it, thank God. President Lyndon Johnson brought the first national attention to the Hill Country in the 60s, when his ranch east of Fredericksburg was the Texas White House. Until then, the Hill Country was a well-kept secret, known primarily to well-to-do folks from Dallas and Houston, who sent their children to summer camps on the Guadalupe River around Hunt. That anonymity, it turns out, was a blessing. While practically everywhere else worth visiting in the American West was getting loved to death, the Hill Country remained unsullied. The first wave of visitors who started showing up in large numbers 20 years ago or so were bluebonnet lovers, peach eaters, canoeists and tubers, fishermen and hunters, your basic harried urbanites fleeing the city in search of an escape. Many were inspired by a 1975 song called Luckenbach, Texas, sung by Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. It didn't matter that the song was written by a Memphis producer and a Nashville musician who'd never actually been to the little village with five buildings, including a dance hall. Their sentiment in romanticizing the Hill Country experience was dead on target, as expressed in the refrain, "Maybe it's time we got back to the basics." Crowds responded in kind, returning to the roots they never had. More recently, though, movie types have been moving in from Hollywood, and a second wave of visitors has come from all over Texas and the world beyond. The word is out that the Hill Country has the same enchanting natural beauty once attributed to places like Santa Fe, Sedona, Scottsdale, and Carmel. But being discovered often comes at the expense of the very qualities that attracted visitors in the first place. Hill Country land values, formerly pegged to the amount of tillable soil or the availability of water, are escalating rapidly based solely on aesthetic beauty. Visitors are being turned away from Enchanted Rock whenever the parking lot fills to capacity. The Hunt General Store now carries its Sunday New York Times, all of which raises the specter of the Hill Countries becoming more of a hot spot and less of a state of mind. For all of my adult life, I've visited places in and near the Hill Country. Kerrville for the Folk Music Festival, Fredericksburg for peaches, Llano for barbecue, the rivers for swimming and canoeing. Yet I have seldom thought of the Hill Country as a single place, rather than as individual destinations. So I got in my pickup and started driving. I came back with a route I call my ultimate Hill Country tour. A 400-mile trip that can be done in a weekend, but that I savored over 4 days. I purposely excluded towns on the geographic fringe, such as Llano, Brady, Rock Springs, and Burnet. Sorry, but the Hill Country is not north of the Colorado, at least not in my book. And places that have already made the transition from bucolic small town to big city suburb, like New Braunfels, Burney, and Dripping Springs. Also bypassed were standalone tourist destinations like Bandera and the LBJ historic attractions on the way to Fredericksburg. But if you want to find out what the real Hill Country is all about, hop in and see for yourself before it changes too much. Devil's Backbone to Fredericksburg. San Antonio and Austin are the usual entry points to the Hill Country, since that's where the major highways are. But mile after mile of suburbia deflates the drama of entering the hills. A better approach is from San Marcos on Ranch Road 12. Just went west of Interstate 35, the limestone escarpment known as the Balcones Fault rears up dramatically from the prairie. About 4 miles past the turnoff to Wimberley are two classic examples of Texas roadhouses, Riley's Backbone Place and the Devil's Backbone Tavern. Both are named for the ridgeline called Devil's Backbone. Riley's is a hangout popular with Southwest Texas State University students headed to nearby Canyon Lake, but the Devil's Backbone Tavern is more my style, with a fireplace and a just plain folks clientele. The vistas finally kicked in just beyond the two beer joints, as the road began at Serpentine Road atop the backbone, which separates the Blanco and Guadalupe River basins. I pulled over to a picnic area on the right side, about a mile past the taverns, so I could take in the views of the Blanco winding its way through gentle Wimberley Valley. I'd arrived in Hill Country. The first town, Fisher, is one of the smaller German settlements in the region, distinguished by a 121-year-old community dance hall and a nine-pin bowling club, nine pins being another imported German tradition that persists in the Hill Country. Although the bowling club is private, members usually tolerate visitors who stop in for a look. Fisher's town store closed back in the 80s, but the tin building on cedar posts remained open as the post office, with all the store's fixtures intact. 3 years later, Gertrude Fisher, the fifth-generation postmaster, took early retirement after 19 years on the job. Once she stepped down, higher-ups in the Postal Service directed that the post office be relocated next door to a new modular structure resembling a trailer home. How could anyone shutter up a historic building almost 100 years old? I put that question to Gertrude, who was picking up beer cans outside the old store. I liked her answer. My daughter's going to reopen the store, sell trinkets, maybe even do barbecue, if she ever slows down, she said. But there isn't a timetable for the grand reopening. Her record business is keeping her busy, though. After Fisher, the hills began to flatten, and I headed for Blanco, one of the Hill Country's more underappreciated burgs. The town's namesake river is shallow, swift, and eminently swimmable. A nature trail leads from the town square to the river, but I prefer Blanco State Park, which borders the river as it passes beneath US 281. More than once, I've impulsively pulled over in the midst of a summer trip to cool off by the dam in the park. I blame Blanco's image problem on its loss of the county seat to Johnson City in 1891. leaving the stately courthouse on the square without a purpose. I'm happy to report that Blanco finally seems to be getting over that misfortune. Christmas lights now adorn the old abandoned building year-round, and practically every storefront on the square is rented. There's enough commerce to support two Chat and Chews, the venerable Blanco Bowling Club Cafe just off the square, known for its truck stop style enchiladas and its nine-pin alley in the back, and the Pecan Street Cafe and Bakery on the square, whose fresh ground coffee, herbal tea and sweets cater to a clientele that formerly didn't exist in the Hill Country. By this time, I was feeling the urge to get out of the car and onto the land. But the lack of good trails is one of the Hill Country's few drawbacks. To find one, I had to head north to 5,212-acre Pedernales Falls State Park. I took the roundabout route through Henley because there's an eyeball-dazzling vista looking back toward Blanco, following the climb out of the river basin. At the park, I tromped down a well-trod path shaded by oak and juniper, rolled up my pants, and commenced to leap from rock to rock in the falls, which aren't Niagara-like 90-degree drops, but rather a sloping mega-rapid. Leaving the park, I chose the back road into Johnson City, the town founded by Lyndon Johnson's forebears. Long moribund, Johnson City is finally showing signs of rebirth. I have seen every parking space around the intersection of Main and Nugent filled at lunchtime. Many of the visitors are shopping and eating at the Feed Mill Mall. I prefer two highway restaurants, Charles's for burgers and cobbler, and the Hill Country Cupboard for chicken fried steaks. You can't miss the mall. Started 3 years ago by an artist named Charles Trois, the whimsically redesigned mall has likenesses of zebras and an armadillo converting atop the old stacks. I explored the mill's maze of shops, including one called the Enchanted Olive, which was named for the merchandise instead of the proprietor, a wine tasting room, and out back a petting zoo, a big red fire engine, and a carousel. Back on the street, I found a handmade pickled pine bench for $364 at the Lodgepole Fine Home Furnishings, and an Heshu and Puebla pickled pine wardrobe for $700 at Lagartos, which specializes in Mexican imports. The LBJ National Historic Park, including Lyndon's boyhood home and his grandfather's log cabin, was just a block away, and I decided to revisit the excellent photo exhibit at the headquarters. Afterward, I stuck with my plan to avoid the heavily traveled strip of US 290 between Johnson City and Fredericksburg that passes the Johnson Ranch. Instead, I took the back road north of Johnson City that cuts across rolling hills and lush Pedernales River bottomland. Notable by their absence were billboards, power lines, and along some stretches, even fences. This wasn't some contrived version of the Hill Country for tourists and weekend ranchers. This was the real thing. It was 22 miles from US 281 to Willow City, a wide clearing in the cedar breaks. I stocked up on drinks and munchies at Harry's on the Loop, the convenience store and beer joint that is the last pit stop before the most scenic stretch of highway in this part of the Hill Country, the Willow City Loop. The 18-mile drive descends to the floodplain of Coal Creek, twisting and turning along the creek bed. Along the way, the limestone of the Hill Country yields to the pink granite boulders of the Llano Uplift. The yucca-speckled cliffs and craggy outcroppings were the sort of terrain that I expect to find in the Hill Country of Big Bend, not in northeastern Gillespie County. The loop ended at Texas Highway 16, and the turnoff to Enchanted Rock was just up the road. Coming in from the north through Llano County was worth the roundabout approach for the site of the humongous granite dome rising 425 feet above the scrub oak, Texas persimmon, Mexican buckeye, and prickly pear along the Sandy Creek. 10,000 years worth of human presence has been recorded around the big old chunk, which itself is estimated to be a billion years old. Indians who once lived in the area attributed mystical powers to this batholith, as the rock is technically known, and believed that spirits lived inside it. Enchanted Rock does seem to have an inner life, as I have heard it creak and crack in the evening following a warm day. Modern pilgrims are discovering that it's more and more difficult to find an empty pew in this holy church of stone. Since Enchanted Rock was designated a state natural area almost 20 years ago, the visitor count has skyrocketed, exceeding 350,000 last year. State parks officials recently instituted a controlled entry policy. Whenever the parking lot fills up, which is more often than not the case on spring and early fall weekends, visitors are barred from entering. I got lucky. Even though it was a perfect 70-degree day, a few spaces were still left. I made the ascent, something practically any able-bodied person can do with relative ease, and was rewarded with the best panorama there is of the hill country. I resisted the temptation to drive up to Llano, where Kenneth Laird, Cooper's, and Inman's heat up the best barbecue in the vicinity, only to encounter road signs bent on luring me to beef jerky heaven at Robke's Table Ready Meats, 5 miles east of Crabapple. In the end, though, I took the roads less traveled. Gillespie County's extensive network of paved back roads. Making use of the county map provided by the Chamber of Commerce in Fredericksburg, I picked up my way through undulating farmland toward Cherry Spring. Along the way, I discovered several outstanding examples of the built-to-last German limestone style, including the old Cherry Spring School, Das Alte Schulhaus, the Gothic limestone Christ Lutheran Church, and the magnificent three-story road home and its adjacent massive limestone barn. The once-closed Cherry Spring Dance Hall, with its rough cedar exterior, cedar plank tables, and posters of Webb Pierce and young Elvis Presley on the wall, reopened on weekends this year. I headed toward Das on a road that turned out to be a dead end, but not a total loss. I conversed with a large flock of talkative sheep, watched an armadillo root for insects at the edge of the road, and spotted upward of a dozen wild turkeys gobbling through the brush. I gave up on Das and headed south on US 87 to the Hilltop Cafe. What was once a derelict gas station is now an unpretentious roadhouse diner run by Brenda and Johnny Nicholas that is one of the hot spots in the hill country. Brenda and Johnny specialize not in German fare, but in Cajun and Greek cuisine, reflecting the couple's ethnic backgrounds. Memorabilia from Johnny's days and nights as a touring musician are tacked to the walls and ceiling, and the vintage pinball machine provides the requisite atmosphere, which is sometimes enhanced on weekends by appearances of his musician friends, such as pianist Nick Connolly and Floyd Domino, and guitarists Stephen Bruton and Steve James. Although reservations are absolutely required when dining on Friday and Saturday nights, book at least 2 weeks in advance. I arrived in the late afternoon when there were plenty of tables. I opted for a gyro, a beef and lamb sandwich that would have passed for authentic even in the Plaka in Athens, over the gumbo or the shrimp mistellini bathed in garlic. It was only 10 miles to Fredericksburg, but the difference between rural North Gillespie County and the county seat is measured in more than miles. Fredericksburg to Kerrville. With its outstanding 19th century buildings, famed Texas architect Alfred Giles lived here. Its 200 bed and breakfast inns in the Sunday house tradition, and its unabashed Teutonic flavor. Fredericksburg is the hill country's most charming big town, and one of its most historic. Even the facades of the Walmart and McDonald's have Deutsch Tech's ornamentation. From May 3rd through 12th, the whole town will be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the arrival of John O. Musbach and 126 German immigrants. But the next morning, I felt that I was already in the midst of a festival. Main Street's wide sidewalks were clogged with tourists making their way from shop to shop. Unlike most small towns in America, Fredericksburg's downtown never did decline. The Palace Movie Theater still shows first-run films. Dooley's continues to uphold the tradition of the old five and dime. The old-time fun shop stops whoopee cushions, hand buzzers, plastic vomit, and other timeless jokes, pranks, and magic tricks. The Bauer Toy Museum displays a scale model of League City, circa 1930, and too many old kiddie cars, trucks, trains, and guns, and rocking horses to count. And established businesses, such as the Dietz and Fredericksburg bakeries, operate pretty much the same as they always have. But on closer inspection, Main Street, a.k.a. Hauptstrasse, has undergone quite a transformation. In addition to the profusion of specialty shops and upscale flea market stalls between the courthouse and the old Steamboat Hotel, now the Admiral Nimitz Museum and Historical Center, there is a cluster of smart, high-end home furnishing stores catering to the new hill country style. Another store sells nothing but dulcimers manufactured in town. At Varney's Chemist Laden, the retail store on Main for the Fredericksburg Herb Farm, located six blocks away, bottles of herb-flavored vinegars were practically flying out the door. I counted three establishments featuring ice cream and sodas, and one, the Clear River Pecan Company, which touts its fudge, had a line of customers that extended out to the sidewalk. There were no dominoes in the Domino Parlor Antique Shop, nor domino players. All across town, the restaurants were packed, especially the German ones. Friedhelm's Bavarian Cafe, the Plateau Cafe, and upscale Der Lindenbaum. Is it just a matter of time before a Victoria's Secret, Chili's, or Godiva Chocolates opens for business and t-shirts outnumber bakeries? The thought sent me fleeing to Cross Mountain on the north side of town. It took a 15-minute walk up a path to the top of the tallest hill around, 1,915 feet above sea level, topped by a sheet metal cross. From this height, Fredtown looked serene and postcard perfect, snuggled into emerald pasture lands. I kept the image with me as I left town and headed east to Luckenbach, hoping to recover from the memory of Main Street's hordes. The sylvan scene at Luckenbach was just as I remembered it. The tin store, the town's business office, the old gin, and the dance hall with its shutters closed hadn't changed a bit. A couple of old boys pitched washers while a fresh-faced kid in a raggedy cowboy hat was strumming his guitar. An older couple was loading souvenirs into the trunk of a Cadillac with Iowa plates. In fact, about the only new thing in 20 years has been the bust by the front door of the late Hondo Crouch, the professional old coot and storyteller who made the Luckenbach synonymous with laid back. Thelan Howley, the town manager, confided that keeping Luckenbach laid back has not been easy. For a while we had a problem with bikers and drunks, but we've got that under control, so families can have a good time here without being harassed. Howley has explained the line of t-shirts, postcards, and other souvenirs for sale in the store, where Sheriff Marge, the cantankerous barkeep, and Jimmy Lee Jones, her fellow bartender, and a Willie Nelson lookalike, serve cold long necks and soda pop to customers. The venerable dance hall lights up on most Saturday nights. Tish Hinojosa, the Austin country folk singer-songwriter, will host the Bluebonnet Ball there on April 6th. Valanne offered to show me the road back to comfort. She shut down the office and enlisted her assistant Maggie Montgomery to accompany us. We headed west on Great Town Road, passing near the palatial ranch home of Madeline Stowe and Brian Benben, who are among the many Hollywood celebrities who have bought land around Fredtown. We stopped at Great Town to admire the arch above the driveway of Eintracht Schützenverein, the 109-year-old shooting hall where the community marksmanship competition is still held every year. Back on the road, Maggie pointed out the abandoned town of Bankersmith, an old rail stop that was once said to be patronized by train robber Jesse James. We pulled over at the turnoff to Alamo Springs, an aging hippie enclave, to take in the view of the old tunnel wildlife management area. I couldn't see the entrance to the abandoned 920-foot railroad tunnel dug through the hill that divides the Pedernales and Guadalupe River valleys, But Maggie told me that at sunset, you could see the tunnel's colony of bats emerge. On Saturday and Thursday evenings from June to October, Parks and Wildlife guides lead tours to the tunnel entrance. Fel Ann said Comfort was her favorite German town in the hill country, not as well preserved as Fredericksburg, but a whole lot looser in attitude. Settled by radical freethinkers from Germany who fled political and religious persecution, the town sets itself apart by having the state's only Civil War monument to the north on a public street. The Truder Union Monument on the west end of High Street, commemorating the Loyalist soldiers of German descent who were killed by Confederate troops at the Battle of the Nueces in 1862. High Street, Comfort's main thoroughfare, appears to have been frozen in time. The businesses housed in solid limestone fortresses and old clapboard homes appeared to cater as much to locals as to out-of-towners, typified by the Ingenhut General Store and the Comfort Common Shops in the old Ingenhut Faust Hotel. I admired the pine antiques at Southwestern Elegance, rare books at the old Fire Station Antique Mall, and European crystal at Fritzie's. The prices were generally lower than at comparable stores in Fredericksburg or Kerrville. I was particularly taken with Fulton and Company, one block off High on Main, housed inside an Alfred Giles building that was as fine a work as the hand-painted china, petit point, filigree, and antique desks sold inside. True to the town's free-thinking origins, the Comfort Art Gallery is actually an artist's guild or cooperative. Rather than merely showing films, the 7th Street Theater has converted to staging live dramas with local actors. Val Ann said that if I wanted to know anything about anyone in town, I should see Gail Montana, the proprietor of the Comfort Barbershop. But Gail had already hung out the closed sign for the day, although she carefully left the checkerboard on the shop's porch in case anyone got a hankering to play. By this time it was getting dark. After a mess of ribs at Buzzy's Barbecue, Val Ann and Maggie headed back to Luckenbach, and I drove on to Kerrville. The Hill Country's biggest town, population 9,134, nearly three times the size of Fredericksburg, Kerrville spans the Guadalupe River. It was the region's first resort and retirement community, a place where sufferers of tuberculosis, like country singer Jimmy Rogers, came to recuperate in the 20s. But the completion of Interstate 10 touched off a growth spurt that has obliterated most of Kerrville's small-town ambience. Still, the older part of downtown rated a stroll. My attention was drawn to a wooden duck decoy and an ancient red scooter at the Water Street Antique Company and Tea Room, the Hill Country's largest, and to Spanish Pueblo doors at nearby Artesian Accents. But it's hard to say whether the items or their prices, a steep $165 for the scooter, a bargain $412 for the door, were more noteworthy. The 127-year-old Shriner's department store next to the original Shriner mansion was more to my liking. Lunch in the new Hill Country was Cajun-style pork roast, mashed potatoes, and fresh, not canned, green beans, accompanied by a glass of Burgundy at Joe Jefferson Street Cafe, housed in a two-story, restored Victorian mansion. At least there's chicken fried steak on the menu. Polished off by a fizzy Coca-Cola at Pample's Antiques and Soda Fountain. Another local attraction is the Cowboy Artists of America Museum. But since my appreciation of Western art is limited to the cartoons of Kerrville native son Ace Reed, I decided to roll on down the road. Kerrville to Concan. The busy highway west of Kerrville starts out through one of the least appealing commercial strips found in the Hill Country, but the scenery soon improves. At Ingram, I took a brief detour on the old Ingram Loop to a collection of rock buildings that has been gentrified into something of an arts and craft colony, and returned to the main road for some of the prettiest riverfront and most expensive real estate in the Hill Country. Lining the cypress-shaded banks of the Guadalupe were lavish private homes constructed of limestone that defined the local version of gracious living. Intermingled with the homes were the occasional resort, upscale and downscale, and summer camps whose cabins were visible from the highway. In Hunt, where the two branches of the Guadalupe come together at a great wading spot, I detoured 2 miles up the North Fork Road to view the replicas of Stonehenge and Easter Island statuary that a rancher has placed in a pasture. More weird architecture awaited me back at Hunt, where the unusual wood, cement, and limestone facade of the Hill Country store owes its inspiration to the Cedar Chopper meets Gaudi school. Beyond Camp Mystic, the South Fork Road became curvier as it crossed and recrossed the Guadalupe numerous times, and the landscape turned rockier and drier. Then the river was gone. The oaks gave way to juniper, and the hill country faded into the desiccated ranchland of the Edwards Plateau. I turned south toward Vanderpool, through more of the same, until the road suddenly dropped off the plateau into the Sabinal River Canyon, the site of Lost Maples State Natural Area. This is one of the few places in Texas where you can see fall colors, if you can get through the traffic jams on November weekends. On this spring afternoon, though, the park was almost deserted. I had my choice of 2 4-mile hiking trails and took the one along the river. But irritating signs prohibiting any contact with the water led me to cut the hike short and get on to one of the best drives in Texas, Route 337 to Lakey. That's Lakey, not as in water, not leaky as in faucet. It climbs back to the canyon's rim and begins a roller coaster ride through the highest, steepest, and most rugged part of the hill country. For the next 18 miles, the highway switchbacks up and down a series of ridge lines, skittering along the edges of sheer cliffs and dropping down into wrinkled, creek-carved valleys. I stopped in Lakey, where most of Frio Canyon's businesses are located, and grabbed a real milkshake made with Bluebell ice cream at the Lakey drugstore. The little town borders the Frio River, which, next to the Guadalupe, is the Hell Country's most popular waterway, particularly the 17 miles between Lakey and Concan. Along its banks are vacation homes, less chic than those on the Guadalupe, stables, campgrounds, cabins, and ever-popular Garner State Park. On warm weather weekends, the Saturday night dance at the park's pavilion is the social event of the entire Western Hill Country. I settled in for the night at Neil's Lodges in Concan. The appeal of its screen cabins is a location on a bluff above one of the best swimming holes on the Frio. I jumped in immediately, and I am pleased to report that its water is clean and clear, at least until the summer invasion of the hill country. Concan to Blanco. The homeward leg of my hill country tour took me first to Utopia, a small, sleepy hamlet on the Sabinal River, where the social idealism of the town's name is reflected by the community gardens, organic, of course, and a bottled water plant. At Vanderpool, I picked up Rural Route 337 again, but the vertigo-inducing views of the previous day's wild drive on the western segment of the road were replaced by pastoral scenes and fields of wildflowers. The rural setting, the easy curves, the cloudless sky, and the aroma of spring made driving in the hill country pure pleasure. It really doesn't get any better than this. My reverie was broken by Medina, a once declining town that has been reborn as the apple capital of Texas. Although the Texas International Apple Festival won't be held until the peak of harvest season, on the last weekend in July, I still got my fill of this increasingly popular hill country specialty crop at Love Creek Orchards. This combination of bakery, cider mill, and country store is the repository of all things apple: strudel, jelly, mulled cider, chutney, ice cream, earrings, peelers, live saplings, and even apple strudel coffee beans. It was enough to make me forget peaches until summer. Near Bandera, the road climbed up Bandera Pass. It doesn't look like much, but this modest piece of high ground has twice played a role in Texas history. Spanish troops battled a band of Apaches here in 1732 and established the pass as a line of demarcation separating the two civilizations. 110 years later, a small group of Texas Rangers reestablished the line by fighting off a Comanche war party twice its size at the same spot. Later, the pass was guarded by soldiers from Camp Verde. Its former location, now on private island, is noted by a historical marker. A U.S. cavalry outpost established in 1856, Camp Verde was the site of an army experiment, promoted by Secretary of War Jefferson Davis to use camels as pack animals on the frontier. The Civil War brought the experiment to an end, and occupying Confederate troops let many of the camels run off. 4 years after the war, Camp Verde was abandoned. On the other hand, the old Camp Verde General Store, established 139 years ago to accommodate troops on weekend leave from the camp, is thriving. One of the finest general stores in the entire hill country, the current building, built at the turn of the century, has a shaded porch, a large patio, and gardens next to a creekside park. The store sells all kinds of implements, tools, toys, books, maps, seeds, camel memorabilia, and sundry useful and useless items found only in general stores, such as pickled eggs and rat cheese. I loaded up on 5 kinds of jelly beans from the old-fashioned candy section. I was smelling the barn now. I drove straight through Comfort, made a side trip to Waring just so I could say I was halfway between welfare and comfort, and crossed First Coffee Hollow Draw and Second Coffee Hollow Draw. At Sisterdale, symbols of the new and old hill country are the 2 main attractions. I passed an idle hour, sipping Cabernet Sauvignon at the Sister Creek Vineyards, feeling as if I were in a European painting. Vineyards, a rock farmhouse, spreading oaks, a perfectly manicured lawn. Call me provincial if you want to, but I can't imagine that the south of France could be more pleasant. Plus, I don't think there's anywhere in the south of France like the Sisterdale General Store and Bar down the street. I pulled up a stool at the 100-year-old bar and ordered up a cool one from Valeria Woolven, the radiant white-haired bartender with a decided accent. In a matter of minutes, I learned that Woolven doesn't merely tend bar, but also serves as hostess and referee for the games of dominoes, moon, and 42 that are played Tuesday afternoon and Thursday nights. She's also the town historian, who likes to recount all the rich and famous folks who've stopped at her store over the years. That Dan Rather, he was something else, she chuckled cryptically. She guided me from the bar to the store, where she showed off a life-size cutout of George Strait, holding a can of Bud Light, with Strait's autograph across his shoulder. I reluctantly took my leave of Valeria Woolven and got back on the road. 20 miles of curves and hills later, I arrived at the junction with U.S. 281, the primary north-south highway through the hill country. San Antonio was a straight shot south, Blanco was 7 miles north, and beyond it the turnoff to Austin. Home was 15 minutes away, a pleasant ramble along the unsullied Little Blanco River Valley to a nice little spot near Devil's Backbone. You see, I discovered that I liked the hill country so much, I moved there.
This is Kay, reading from the Texas Monthly Archives. Food and drink. Mexican martini. It's guaranteed to make your favorite urban cowgirl or cowboy happier than an armadillo digging grubworms. By Courtney Bond. Issued June 2013. Many a youthful happy hour did I spend at Austin's famously peripatetic Cedar Door Bar, the self-proclaimed inventor of our state's most famous native cocktail, the Mexican Martini. A frosty metal shaker of sweet tart elixir, a salt-encrusted coupe glass, fat green olives impaled on a wee plastic sword, this was what summer in Texas was made of. Little did I know the bar's concoction was just a glorified margarita, made exotic by a novel presentation that's DIY, yet somehow decorous, until you pour half of it on the table. According to Cedar Door lore, the idea was introduced to the bar about 30 years ago by an employee who returned from Mexico with tales of a margarita served up rather than on the rocks. The Austin establishment latched onto the idea. Someone dubbed the drink a Mexican martini, prompting someone else to throw in some olives, and the rest is history. Alas, the Mexican martini you're likely to get nowadays is a mass-market imposter composed of pre-made margarita mix and delivered in a cloudy plastic shaker. And recipes for the home mixologist are all over the map, from nothing more than a top-shelf margarita with some olives to a syrupy abomination mixed with Sprite. Yuck! So I and my otherwise sensible colleagues experimented until we came up with something that jibes with what folks think they're drinking and what we think they ought to be. In this recipe, smoky tequila squares off with salty olive brine, while sweet orange liqueur plays mediator. Not particularly Mexican and not a martini, this is a damn tasty, fittingly weird gift from Austin to the rest of the world. Mexican martini serves 1-3 ounces añejo tequila, 1 1/2 ounces Cointreau, 1 1/2 ounces fresh lime juice, 1/2 ounce green olive brine from the jar, a splash of fresh orange juice, lime wedges, and olives. Agitate everything in an ice-filled shaker, then strain into a small chilled coupe or martini glass rimmed with salt. Add a couple of olives and a lime wedge. Proceed to drink slowly, preferably with a basket of chips and a bowl of salsa, and clear your calendar for the rest of the day. Hello, this is Kay, reading from the Texas Monthly Archives. Food and Drink, Peach Ice Cream, Cranks a Lot, by Courtney Bond, issue June 2017. When I was growing up, ice cream was a non-negotiable in my family's food pyramid. My paternal grandfather would not have dreamed of letting an evening pass without a bowl of Bluebell. Not ice cream, mind you, Bluebell. And my dad and I had our own post-dinner ritual, which involved one of us trying to cajole the other to get up from his or her lazy boy and commence the arduous task of liberating the hard-packed stuff from the carton. "You dipping?" he'd holler hopefully, if I made even the slightest move. So what a revelation it was to later discover the soft, creamy smoothness of homemade ice cream, the same kind that was a regular treat when my mom was a kid. She remembers when churning up a batch of the frosty stuff was an every weekend occasion, and the little ones would sit on top of the towel-covered cranking mechanism to keep it steady. There's no shortage of premium ice creams out there now, but as with many things, nothing beats homemade. Like smoking meat and boiling crawfish, making ice cream, particularly when it involves a half hour of old-fashioned physical exertion, is a festive event, a way to celebrate the bounty of the season, peaches, and bring your favorite people together. Makes 1 quart, 1 1/2 cups, half and half, 1 cup sugar divided, 2 eggs, beaten, 1 1/2 cups heavy cream, 3 teaspoons vanilla extract, 1/4 teaspoon salt, 2 cups finely chopped fresh peaches, peeled, 1 tablespoon lemon juice. In a small saucepan, heat the half and half over medium-high heat, stirring often until it gets bubbly around the sides. Turn heat to low, and gradually add 1/2 cup sugar, stirring till dissolved. Add the eggs and heat, whisking constantly. Mixture should register no more than 170 degrees on a candy thermometer. Transfer the mixture to a bowl, preferably with a spout, and stir in the cream, vanilla, and salt. Cover and put in the refrigerator. Chill for at least 3 hours and preferably overnight. Meanwhile, combine the peaches, remaining sugar, and lemon juice in a bowl and refrigerate for at least 2 hours, stirring occasionally. When you're ready to make the ice cream, strain the juice from the peaches and add to the cream mixture. Set peaches aside. Freeze according to your maker's instructions. When the ice cream is almost finished, about 25 minutes in a hand crank machine, add in the peaches and continue freezing till done.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 93 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Please note that in order to protect the safety of volunteers and staff and recording services around the country at this time, some productions have been reduced or eliminated. The show that follows substitutes for the program regularly scheduled for this time.
Swinging Down the Lane with David Miller. I send a warm greeting to listeners to station KSJE, broadcasting from Farmington, New Mexico. We're about to embark on another episode that I call Close Encounters, reminiscing about occasions when I was privileged to hear some great music. You may remember from the last episode that I was on the motor ship Norway, which was plying the Caribbean Sea. One of the members of our dinner group, who lived in Toronto, brought to my attention that another Canadian named Peter Appleyard would be giving a concert the next day on the ship. The name drew a blank, and he was surprised, knowing that I was a big fan of Benny Goodman. Sure enough, when I got back to my studio, I realized that Appleyard, who played the vibes, was with Goodman from 1971 to 77. I found a reference to a recording date in 71 when he was part of a quartet that included Goodman on clarinet, Derek Smith on piano, and Howie Ray on drums. Talking about the session, Appleyard had said, "Though I'd played with Benny before, this was my first record with him. I've done thousands of recordings, but this session was one of the highlights of my life. A very memorable experience. It always is when I play with Benny. There's an aura about him." Well, let's listen to the tune that he recorded as part of the quartet on that day in 1971. It's the tune that Johnny Mandel and Paul Francis Webster wrote as the theme song for the movie The Sandpiper. Here is The Shadow of Your Smile. Thank you. The session on shipboard that featured Peter Appleyard was a most enjoyable mini-concert, during which he pulled a Lionel Hampton trick, playing two-finger piano and drums, as well as the vibraphone. When the ship returned to Florida, there was a long line of folks waiting to disembark. My wife and I struck up a conversation with a couple whom we hadn't seen before. It turned out to be Paul Tanner and his wife Jan. Paul, I learned, was one of two remaining members of the original Glenn Miller Civilian Band. The other was Tex Beneke. Paul, like Glenn, played trombone, which meant that he never played solos. Glenn took them all himself. Paul, though, carved out a successful career in music, eventually becoming a very popular professor at UCLA. I'll have much more to say about Paul on upcoming episodes, but for now, let's give him an opportunity to demonstrate his skill on the trombone. We hear a medley of songs from George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.